We'll start with a brief prayer. First, a quick introduction. I am Father Elias. This is my wife, Lydia and Sylvia. Yes, I am a Catholic priest. Yes, I am married. What many people don't realize is that the Roman Catholic Church is a church in communion with 23 sister churches, all of which are Eastern churches. So with the Christian Eastern churches in communion with Rome, we maintain some of the customs from apostolic times, such as married clergy, i.e. if you're already married and called to orders, either the diaconate or priesthood, you can be ordained. So we'll start with a prayer from our tradition to the Holy Spirit, as we need help to get this talk well. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. Heavenly King, soul, spirit, and truth, present in all places, knowing all things, the treasury of blessings and the giver of life. Come and dwell in us, cleanse us of all stain, save our souls, O God. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. I wish I could tell you how long we've been doing this talk, but we can't remember. It's been a while.
Adam.
Adam!
News, there's a big monster in here!
Yeah, I'm reading the paper, okay?
Adam!
Yeah, just send
help
it away.
Me!
Yeah, it's okay. This is our rendition of the fall. Adam and Eve. Eve was threatened. The underlying language in Genesis is indicates a monster, not just a serpent, but something large and menacing. And Adam was right there, we know from the text, but he essentially did nothing. We've been paying the price ever since. Want to do the others? The others?
Maybe this is how it should have gone. Adam.
Yes, dear.
Adam.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a monster. Adam! And you would probably have been killed.
Yes, but that is part of the vocation of manhood in marriage. So we're going to talk to you tonight about the Catholic vision of marriage and how it's really... it's an experience of life-giving love. It's not about sort of two people who agree to sort of get whatever they can out of the relationship. It's a relationship between people willing to lay down their lives for each other. So, I need my first volunteer for the night to read. Anyone? Ah, you're making eye contact. Okay. Would you mind reading from paragraph 1601 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church?
Oh, they're looking in the book I had.
Oh.
No, you need your catechism.
Okay, sorry. Anyone have a catechism? Do you mind if we pass that around?
I don't mind at all. What was the number?
Oh, it's paragraph 1601.
All right. Who wants to go first? Who made on?
Okay. Thank you. And what's your name?
Isabel.
Okay. As we call on you, we'll ask your names and we'll try to remember them. So.
You want me to read the first paragraph?
Yes, please. Just 1601, the first part.
Okay. The matrimonial covenant by which a man and a woman establish between themselves a partnership of the whole of life is by nature ordered towards the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. This covenant between baptized persons has been raised by Christ the Lord to the dignity of a sacrament.
Okay, so we're going to unpack that in just a second, but I want to go back to our original story just for a second. Adam and Eve, right? What role did Adam play? Was he there to help and protect? Or did he kind of check out? Survey says?
Check
that. Okay. He's supposed to lay down his life for you, right? And set a model for what marriage is meant to be. And he didn't live out the vocation of life-giving love for his spouse, right? And so we can argue that marriages have been falling into that same pattern ever since. And that's part of the fall. So part of being in marriage is being a gift to one's spouse, right? And the idea of the law of the gift, Adam and Eve were created to be emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically a complete gift one to the other. So we tend to think of others who are different as, you know, difficult, but their complementarity was meant to draw them out of themselves and teach them to love in a selfless way. So we can talk about marriage really as a mutual... We can talk about marriage as a mutual martyrdom, right, or martyria. The original meaning of that word is witness. And so in marriage, husbands and wives together witness to Christ. They bear witness to Christ to each other and to the world around them. And this brings us to a key difference, which is that of a covenant versus a contract.
Okay, so if we talk about a contract, what does a contract do? As an instrument, what do we use contracts for?
To buy.
Okay, exactly. And what do, when we're buying, what are we buying? Are we buying ideas? Are we buying culture? What are we buying?
It said to bind.
Oh, did you say to bind?
Yeah, bind.
Well, okay, bind. Okay, yes. And buy is another one, which is actually what I was looking for. Maybe that's why I heard it that way. But yes, contracts are often binding, and we use them to buy. But the point is that a contract buys... which is why marriage is not a contract.
And the biblical idea of covenant is an exchange of persons. And so two people who were not related, through making a covenant, suddenly become the same tribe, the same clan, the same family. They exchange each other and give themselves to each other.
Okay. So we have this idea of, in the Catholic Church, of marriage as a reflection of the Trinity. And this reaches out into a whole host of modern issues. So if we say that here's the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and marriage is supposed to reflect the Trinity, in marriage you have God the Father, a man, and a woman. And they're all in relationship with each other, and as a result, there are offspring as well. But this reflection is why the Catholic Church says, man and dog, woman and Eiffel Tower, it's a thing. They had a small ceremony. They just invited family. So when marriage is a reflection of the Trinity, it insists, logically, that it be between a man, a woman, and God, with no other variations.
Yeah, and we're going to come back to these three points, but the good of the spouses, the procreation of offspring, and the education of offspring. Because these are all ways that husband and wife grow in the image and likeness of Christ through their marriage. You want to call for the next call?
No, you call for volunteers. I'm going to put up.
Got it. No. I would like to call for our next volunteer, please, who will read paragraph 1604. Thank you. And your name was?
Isabel.
Isabel. And your name is?
Alexa.
Okay.
God, who created man out of love, also calls him to love, the fundamental and innate vocation of every human being. For man is created in the image and likeness of God, who is himself love. Since God created him, man and woman, their mutual love becomes an image of the absolute and unfailing love with which God loves man. It is good, very good, in the Creator's eyes. And this love which God blessed is intended to be fruitful and to be realized in the common work of watching over creation. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it.
Thank you. So one comment, you know, it's funny. In modernity, we all use the same words and mean radically different things by them. So for example, tonight we're talking about Christian marriage, as opposed to perhaps a more generic concept of what marriage is. Love is another one of those words. So as Christians, when we say love, we have a very specific meaning. And the ideal of Christian love is a love that gives itself for the good of the beloved. So in our context, right, the good of the beloved is their salvation. So as husbands and wives, you're working together to bring each other to heaven. Should God bless you with children, you're working together to bring those children to heaven. And that's where educating comes in, because the primary education is in faith.
And it's important to note that while most of our culture regards love as love, it's an emotion that you feel that warms your heart and your belly and makes you want to stay with the person
love.
For a while.
Love.
As long as I still feel attracted to you. True love, in this context, is an act of the will that is ongoing. Come on in. Come on in. And sometimes this act of the will is very difficult to make. But this is why it's enduring, because we choose to continue on rather than just wait for the emotion to carry us there. Because this one goes out pretty fast.
Yeah, and just a comment on this too. When we talk about love, as an act of the will versus an emotion. In a moment, we're going to talk about discernment. This is why discerning marriage is really important, right? It's why the church teaches it's not enough to meet someone and say, hey, I think we can get along, or I like your car, or you wear nice clothes, let's get married. Discernment is really meant to take a process of time.
Let's talk more about discernment.
Yeah, and actually, does anyone have their Bibles? Or would like to borrow mine? Everyone looks down for more eye contact.
And they know better now.
I have one of these, too.
Would you mind reading Matthew 19, 10 through 12?
Can we get a definition for the word discernment first? What does it mean to discern? Verb.
Discern. What does discern mean?
Stomp on something? Alexa?
You should know this.
Discern. I'm going to add meant to the end to it. But I'm looking for what discern means. Discern is an act of, we'll call it, educated decision making. So more than just saying cafe latte, frappe, double caramel macchiato. Instead, this is an education, like how much sugar is actually in that double caramel macchiato. That kind of, like, I'm going to do research into it and determine whether or not this is what I need in order to maintain my diabetic equilibrium, or whether or not this might be something that isn't so good for me. So discernment involves educated decision making. Will you tell us what the church says about discernment, please?
Sure. Actually, if I could have Scott read Matthew 19, 10 through 12, it'll
set the tone.
So is that starting at 10?
Matthew 19, 10 through 12. Yeah. Unless I wrote it wrong.
Unless it could be 1 through 12.
Let me double check. I thought we did our QA.
10 seems like an odd place to start this one.
Go to 1 then.
Let me double check. Thank you. Oh, you know what? It's the wrong one. So skip that. I will fix it for next week if we get called back. I apologize.
That's fine.
I had another one in mind. That should not be there. I'll make it a...
I mean, it's about marriage. It's chapter 19, so...
It is indeed. Hold on one second. Let's see if I can save this one. Yeah. Actually, you know what? Go ahead. 10 and 3, 12. 10 seems like an odd place to start, but I'll make it make sense.
Okay.
I'll give it context.
Starting with 10. His disciples said to him, if that is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. He answered, not all can accept this word, but only those to whom that is granted. Said through
12.
Through 12, okay. Some are incapable of marriage because they were born so, some because they were made so by others, some because they have renounced marriage for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Whoever can accept this ought to accept it.
So just some context. The Pharisees, as you probably know, were out to harass Jesus any chance they got. And so they asked him, you know, hey, Moses said it's okay to divorce a woman for any reason. What do you say? And the Lord basically said, that's really not how it was from the beginning. That's not what God intended, but Moses gave a concession because of the hardness of hearts. So the Lord is basically reaffirming what the church teaches, is that marriage is meant to be permanent. Because it's something that's supposed to be permanent, this is why we don't enter into it lightly, like buying a jacket or a car or buying a lottery ticket. And this is where discernment comes in.
So the first part of a Christian's discernment journey always starts with talking to the one who invented us and who designed and hardwired us to function best in a certain situation. So we first involve God, our community, our spiritual director, the people who know us well, like our parents and our friends, and we ask, am I actually even called to marriage? Some people are not. Some people are called to celibacy, that is, a life without sex. And some people are called to live that celibacy in the form of priesthood or the diaconate, and others are called to live in a single lifestyle where they spend their life helping other people instead of focusing on their energy into a married life. So the very first question is, am I even called to get married? This is an important thing to ask before you go down the aisle.
Yeah, that's another reason I asked God to read that passage. Because the Lord says, you know, some are incapable of marriage, or some renounce marriage for the sake of the kingdom. And St. Paul reaffirms that teaching as well. So a lot of times today, in the environment we live in, we just assume, you know, oh, I guess, you know, at some point maybe I'll get married, you know, maybe I won't, and I'll have to do whatever. But not everyone is called to marriage. And so it's important to ask the Lord, okay, what am I called to?
If you discern that you are called to marriage, the next question is, am I called to marry this particular person? And the way that we find out about that is through a process called courtship, which is an old-fashioned way of getting to know a person where the whole sexual part is out of the question. Because right now, in the dating scene, let me just speak to the choir here, right? In the dating scene, it's more often about what's happening that night rather than what's happening 10 years from now. The goal of courtship is to spend time with another person, usually in the company of others, and never after midnight.
It's an old Navy captain I had said, nothing good happens after midnight.
Working toward the answer to two questions. Can I live happily with this person? And the second question, can I live holily with this person? H-O-L-Y, not W-H-O. Those are the two questions to answer. And once you know the answer, which may take 10 minutes, or it may take 6 months of ongoing effort to discern whether or not that's the case, at that point, the courtship is over and a decision is made. Either you move right into an engagement or you go back to this step up here. So the whole purpose of spending time together is only to lead to the answering of those two questions. Can I live with you happily? Can we do something holy out of this? Is your breath good enough? The important questions here. This is a challenge because it involves bringing people into your inner circle, into your family, because your family can help you discern these things. They know you. Your friends know you. And so this courtship is much more of a community event rather than just a single thing that happens between you and him in a restaurant or at a ball game.
Yeah, and Sylvia hits on a really important point, right? We tend to think of ourselves as individuals as opposed to persons in community. So if we think of ourselves primarily as individuals, like we're sort of the starting point and reality orders itself around us. But in the context of the church, right, holy matrimony is a sacrament that essentially ordains that husband and wife for service to the community of the church. So marriage doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens within the community. To Sylvie's point about courtship, the idea of sort of the extended family is sort of lost today. We kind of tend to think of our household as sort of a fortress. So I think part of, you know, making sense of this is realizing we're called to be in community, not just with our spouse, but, you know, with our broader family, our extended network, that sort of thing.
That happened in our courtship.
We
spent a lot of time trying to discern, and I had pretty much decided that he was not the right person for me, and I told him so. Nice guy.
But I had this cool Navy uniform.
You did have a cool Navy uniform.
I looked like the ice cream man.
I think I liked your insurance better. But that's all right. So I told him.
Definitely wasn't the car I was driving.
It was your grandfather's car. It was a nice car. Anyway, we were going to downtown San Francisco, where his mother's church was in a storefront church
not
in the middle
Catholic
of a section
church,
of town that I would not usually have gone.
Right.
And on the way there, and this was before cell phones, we are that old. I told him, I'm sorry, we're just not compatible. So we got to the church, and I'm trying to sneak in, because I'm the only one who looks like me in the entire church. And there was a little old lady at the front of the church, and she was talking to all the women with her microphone, and she had a Bible, and she's talking along, and I'm almost to my seat, and she goes, "You!" And I said, "Yes?" And she said, "Come up here." And I went, "Okay."
She went, "Okay," and I went, "I'm so dead."
Yeah. So he hid behind the pillar, and I walked up to the front of the room, and I said, "Hi." And she looked at me and she goes, "I don't know who you are, and I don't know who you came here with, but I want you to know that you're perfectly compatible with them." So sometimes God chooses to reveal things in surprising ways at very unexpected times. And that was one of them. That was my first insight that maybe I ought to pay more attention to this person. The second was we were out in a park, and we had sat down in the park and were just there. I mean, it was an ordinary moment in time. And suddenly I felt this peace. It was just like this deep contentedness, and I was like, wow, I am totally where I need to be. And that was sort of the proverbial straw that sort of sent it over the edge. I'm like, yeah, okay, this is right. When things are from God, there's peace. Now, I've spoken to two people in this past week, and both of them have said to me, I cried on the night of my wedding, before, you know, the night before I got married, because I knew I wasn't supposed to do it. But we had the dress, and we had the church, and the caterer was calling me on the phone, and the mother-in-law, and, you know, so you feel all that pressure. And part of that was because this discernment process had never happened fully. And so there was this lie that was inside their hearts, and both of them are now divorced. It doesn't take long, because your heart tells you. So discernment as the basis and the key for marriage.
Your turn.
I'm going to read from Faith Explained, just to kind of close out the section on discernment. And you touched on courting, but it looks like we go into that in a little bit more detail. If you want to set up the board for that.
Yep.
So I'm reading from Faith Explained in this version, the third edition. I'm at the bottom of page 519. You guys are still using this, right?
Yes.
Okay. It is a sad but observable fact that people sometimes will exercise more care in choosing a car or a coat than they will in choosing a husband or a wife. In spite of the fact that this is a lifelong, unbreakable union, for better or for worse, into which they are entering. More than that, it is a vocation which they are choosing, a state of life upon which will depend their own salvation and that of their children. So again, marriage is not primarily oriented towards happiness. That is important, certainly. It's primarily oriented towards the salvation of the spouses and their children. And if things are going well, all of that works together. Before pronouncing his vow of chastity and accepting a call to the priesthood, a young man will give several years of prayerful thought under competent spiritual guidance to the wisdom of his choice. So it's a good comparison. Like, we tend to look at religious life as sort of something on a pedestal, like far away from like reality. The fact is, both clergy and married have their own particular, we can call marriage an ordination to service of the people of God in the church. So just as clergy discern before they're ordained, the married couple should also be exercising that same amount of discernment. And then just an obvious comment, the churches of the Christian East where married men were ordained, such as my church, if you know you're going to get married, you won't be ordained until after you have gone through the discernment process, found a wife, gotten married, and have been, you know, in stability of life for about 5 years. So our seminarians will have to do that first, find a marriage partner first.
Another note about discernment. Discernment is something you go into with your eyes open. You don't want to be blinded. So I would like to give you an illustration of what sex does. Sex has a very important purpose. It's designed to unify two people together. So think of this as adhesive tape. You're with somebody, you adhese to them, maybe before you get married, and then when that breaks up, you're ripping your tape off. The next person who comes along, your tape is a little less sticky. You wrap it around again. Well, when this one doesn't work out, you unwrap again, but this time it doesn't take as much skin off. And then again and again until your tape doesn't stick anymore. This is one of the main reasons why the church says sex is important in a certain context, and that context is a monogamous relationship with a person to whom you have a lifelong commitment, so that your tape will work. Because during life, you need the tape to hold you together. At 3 o'clock in the morning when you've got two babies under five and they're screaming and they're both feverish and have diarrhea, you need the tape to hold it together. It's bad. Here's a person who is in the dating process
and not staying away from the sex, because the sex does bind you together. Have you ever seen like a beautiful girl and she's with the most awful guy you've ever seen in your life, and you're like, why is she with him? Why doesn't, you know, and you know that he's not treating her right, and you're like, just leave. She goes, no, I'm not leaving. I can't leave. I love him. Well, she's doing this kind of discernment. She's got her eyes closed. She's totally blind, and instead she's just wrapping herself up. It's like this. Oh, somebody's stable. Oh, yeah, really stable. Oh, yeah, he can, look at this. There's, this guy can totally hold me up. Oh, yeah, okay. Good, okay. I'm just, I'm attached to this guy now. But the problem is, at some point you're going to wake up and realize you're married to a desk. And that's going to be a real problem in your life. So, if you take the sex out of the discernment process, you're going to take the blindfold off your eyes and give you the opportunity to discern, is this guy really someone that I could live happily and holily for the rest of my life? You're not a desk baby, I love you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. If I want, I'd be a compatible desk. any more on courtship or move on?
No, I think we can move on.
Okay, there you go. Oh, okay, you already told that story too. Okay, I'm going to read from Faith Explained, 5:23. So, volunteers, stand at ease. For a dating couple, frequent confession and holy communion are the best safeguard against chiseling on God. This is really what Sylvia was referring to. The best guarantee against tarnishing the beauty and holiness of matrimony by premarital liberties to which the couple have no right. The couple who seek a truly happy marriage will come to the altar secure in the knowledge that they have kept their desire for each other under the control of reason and grace. So, I mean, marriage is nothing if not an ongoing lesson in placing your desires under reason and grace, right? And this is how marriage brings us to maturity, but it starts during the courtship process. And we can't emphasize enough the importance, certainly, of praying together, definitely frequenting the sacraments together, communion and, you know, holy confession.
There's another part to marriage too, and it breaks down this in ourselves. And I think that this is a lot of times why people who get married younger have an easier time with this, with the being married part, because we get older and set in our ways and we like it how we like it, and then we bring somebody else in to our relationship, into our close space, and they don't want to watch Jane Austen every night. And
that grew on me over time, actually.
It did. The whole video game thing, I mean, you know, like they have to put away the video games, and that is sometimes a problem. So marriage hits you right here at the place where you're comfortable and you like to do your own thing. And I think that's how God designed it. Because what else would we let in there that could really get at the heart of where our vices are? The things that we really struggle with that really keep us from God. He keeps me honest, and I really work hard at keeping him honest too.
Indeed.
All right.
With the frequenting of the sacraments together, too, just to comment on that, this isn't just for engaged couples, but certainly when you're married. You know, we always, the couples we work with, we always encourage frequent prayer together. Certainly going to confession together, that doesn't mean you sit there and listen, but, you know, make it a point, put it on the calendar, okay, you know, the first Sunday of the month, we're going to go to confession, you know, as a family or as a couple. And build that habit, because that's another way to allow God's grace to work in your lives and to really overcome the challenges that are just going to come up as part of any human relationship, and certainly as part of marriage. And I see what you're doing. I'm trying to find where I am on the notes.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about video games. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
May I have another volunteer, please?
Everybody.
Everyone
tries.
Is not making eye contact. They're all looking at Scott. This is really strange.
I keep reading.
Well, thank you, Alexa. Is there another volunteer? Someone else who would like to read?
I can read.
Awesome. And what's your name?
Patricia.
Isabella, Alexa, Patricia.
I hope your name ends with an A, too.
Isabel.
Oh,
no,
that
is okay.
Isabel.
People say Isabel.
And if you wouldn't mind reading paragraph 1609. This kind of comes back to what Sylvia was saying a little bit ago.
In his mercy, God has not forsaken sinful man. The punishment consequent upon sin, pain in childbearing and joy, and the sweat of your brow, also embody remedies that limit the damaging effects of sin. After the fall, marriage helps to overcome self-absorption, egoism, pursuit of one's own pleasure, and to open oneself to the other, to mutual aid and self-giving.
Thank you. That's perfect. These words that we just heard, right? Self-absorption, egoism, pursuit of one's own pleasure, being open to the other, mutual aid and self-giving. In modern culture, these sort of sound like strange words because modernity, again, is about seeing yourself as an individual focused on your own desires, your own aims. And so marriage is designed to bring you out of that. I tell people, like, when you hear the word, you know, sinful man or sinful humanity, it's helpful to think of sin in terms of an image the Old Testament uses, which is leprosy. Right? So think of sin not just as breaking rules, but as a sickness that we all have. And it's a tendency to choose that which we like best and only the things that make us comfortable and which we want to do. Any of you have children? What would it be like if you never encouraged your child to crawl or to walk or to stand? It'd be pretty hard to carry them around at least this age, no? So, and if you don't have children, but you have younger nieces or nephews, right, if they're not encouraged to grow, right, they're stunted. And so what happens is, as Christians, marriage is an opportunity to grow. And if we're not open to stepping out of ourselves, even when it's uncomfortable, especially when it's uncomfortable, we're stunted. So we essentially become adults with the faith of, like, 3- and 4-year-olds, but not in a good way, you know, that way.
Sorry. I like it.
Why, thank you.
Sounds good. I put on the board that stuntedness. You know, like the love that we have, it's good, but it's not really self-giving love. Even for someone that we really love, it's kind of messy. It's not always in the right order. So what we have to do is sanctify it, make it holy. And we do that by adding grace. And we don't add the grace, we get the grace through the sacrament. And this is another reason why the Catholic Church is so insistent on there's an order on how we do this. First comes the discernment. Then comes the engagement. Then comes a long marriage prep process, way longer than most religions require. And then after that comes the sealing of this relationship in a sacrament. There are only 7 of these things, and marriage is one of them. That means it's super important. So we get the sacrament. We're standing there in front of the altar. We receive the Eucharist. In front of the sight of God, we become one person instead of two. And then our love, which was messy and self-centered and kind of out of order, becomes love like Christ's love. And we spend the rest of our life learning how to make our love the way that Christ loved us. And what did Christ do for us? Where's the crucifix? There it is. That's what he did for us. It was kind of a bloody mess. But he did that for us so that we could be restored to where we were originally before the fall. Okay. So this is the goal for the rest of our life through marriage, is to learn how to love like Christ did. And it gives us so many opportunities for that. And then children come along, and boy, do they give you more opportunities for that too. So the whole thing is one effort of God to move us closer to him and to be made in his image and likeness.
You.
You're welcome.
May I have another volunteer, please? Back to the catechism. We don't want anyone to get bored, so. Would you care to read?
Sure.
And what's your name, please?
Michaela.
Michaela. Okay. Ends with an A.
There you go. Thank goodness.
Is it
Isabel, Alexa, Michaela, and
Patricia.
That's right. If you wouldn't mind reading paragraph 1641. Could be covered, 1641.
Yeah, that's fine.
By reason of their state in life and of their order, Christian spouses have their own special gifts in the people of God. This grace proper to the sacrament of matrimony is intended to perfect the couple's love and to strengthen their indissoluble unity. By this grace, they help one another to attain holiness in their married life and welcoming and educating their children.
So this is kind of a theme we keep coming back to, holiness in marriage, accepting and educating children. And the thing I'll say is that marriage, as we understand it as Christians, is impossible to do on your own. Without the help of God's grace, it simply cannot be done because it's a superhuman effort, right? In the same way, on their own, no one can really love someone else with the love of Christ, right? To pour out everything they have for them and to hold nothing in reserve. It's an act of grace. So the sacrament of matrimony empowers the couples to live this lofty vision that we're sharing with you tonight.
I'm putting two words on the board, Father Elias.
Unitive
and
procreative.
Okay, give us an intro.
So a few minutes ago, Sylvia talked about sex and the problem of sex in terms of making that part of the sermon process, the sort of try before you buy model. And the whole idea with sex, it was designed by God to, we like to say, for babies and bonding. In the context of marriage, the marital act, it brings a couple together. It helps them grow in their union with each other. And also, at certain times, it results in a child. This is part of the natural process of marriage because children, just like a spouse, helps draw you out of yourself. This doesn't mean that if you're married and cannot have children, your marriage isn't holy. It doesn't mean that your marriage is defective in some way. What it means is that marriage is oriented towards the procreation of children. And the church teaches that any artificial means you introduce into your marriage to limit that or get in the way of that is objectively sinful. So one of the things we try to wrap into our marriage talk is a brief talk on natural family planning, which is not the same as the rhythm method. Okay.
If you'll pick up that book that Scott gave you, that book changed our marriage. We were contracepting at first because I was Protestant at the time and I'd never heard of someone not using contraception. I mean, that was irresponsible and we had to use science because God had given us science, and so science could
actually, it was the little old lady in the Bible Answer Man.
Well, I think you better tell what happened.
So there's a radio show that I used to listen to quite a lot driving home from the shipyards called Bible Answer Man, Ken Kennegrath. He was an apologist. At the time, he was Protestant. He's no longer Protestant. He's an Orthodox Christian now. But he had these great answers. He was very erudite. Now, when he started tagging Roman Catholics to task, I'd turn the radio down, wait for him to be done, and then turn it back up. But Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, oh yeah, I turn it up and enjoy it. So I'm driving home one day. We're newly married. We're contraceptive. And I describe her as a little old lady, but I think she was a young mom, probably driving a large 12 or 15 passenger van. And she asked him a question. Tell me where in the Bible it says contraception is okay. Now, as someone who is recently married, you know, fairly recently catechized, I hear this question and I realize the temperature of my body and my face is rising. I'm getting very uncomfortable. And I'd never heard Hank Kennegrath miss a beat until that call. And so he starts hemming and hawing and stumbling over his words and I can't really believe what I'm hearing. Long story short, I get home and I
Wait,
say...
she told him. The lady on the phone told him.
She said, in my experience, every child that God has given me shows up with a loaf of bread in their mouth.
As if to say, God provides. God provides for you if you are open to life. And that man had no answer for it. And it makes me laugh now that he's an Orthodox Christian because now he's teaching the same thing.
So,
anyhow,
long story short,
when he came home, he sat me down and said, so...
We sat down together.
We sat me down and we had this conversation that was terrifying to me. Like the thought of letting go of my control of this part of our life, I mean, that would totally change my future. And as Sadhan put it, the change in your thinking brought about a change in my physiology. And before long, we were pregnant with our first daughter. And en route to our next duty station, we read the book that you have in front of you, Kumanagite. And it was life-transforming because I recognized in it truth, the capital T truth, not true or false McDonald's carries Big Macs. No, this was truth-like.
And you were still Protestant at this time.
I was still Protestant at the time, but the truth was there, and it was like my heart recognized it, like the same reason you guys are here. My heart knew that this was a thing, and I thought, oh, Lord, have mercy. What is going to happen to us now? And so we had to do some more studying about Humana Vitae. So Humana Vitae came out in the 1960s. Now, I'm going to back up a little bit. Up until 1930, there was not a single Christian denomination that said birth control was okay. All of them said this is anathema. That means cursed. It's hated. It is absolutely a work of the devil. So in 1928 at the Lambeth Conference, the Anglicans were like, maybe there are certain situations. I know what it is. When we have very poor people, in order to eradicate poverty, we're going to allow them to use birth control so that we no longer have the poor with us. We heard that phrase before. Oh, wait a minute. Wasn't that Jesus who said, you will always have the poor with you? In any case, they had the brilliant idea that it was okay in certain circumstances. The minute that door was cracked open, it was thrown wide, and within 15 years, every major denomination, except the Catholics, had okayed contraceptives in virtually every situation possible. Now, contraceptives were not widely available in the market at that time, and it continued that way through the 60s. But if you went to your priest at the time and said, hey, well, we don't really want to have them. We need a Maserati first, and once we have that in our house, then we'll talk about having children. And the priest would say, well, that's between you and your husband or like that. You know, keep that in your bedroom. And he would say, the Pope is about to make a statement that says the Catholic Church is willing to allow contraception as well. So this is the world stage. Everybody is waiting. Come on. Come on. And Pope Paul VI writes that encyclical. And in it he says, listen up, y'all. If you do this, if you open this door and you allow contraception to be mainstream available, five things are going to happen. Number one, the general immorality of the culture is going to go down. This was in the late 1960s. Did we see a decrease in morality between 1960 and, say, 2022? Women are going to become objectified. You know any women that have been objectified by the use of contraception? Things like the slave trade. Trade in human flesh? Yeah. He said, governments will begin using this as a means of controlling their population and they will enforce the use of birth control. It wasn't but about 5 years later when China instituted their one child rule. Two more things. What were they?
I think you already talked about loss of respect for women.
Loss of respect for women. And women in poverty, that the poverty of just women would increase. And we see that now. We have all kinds of social projects to address that, women in poverty. So within the next few years after this happened, because, of course, everybody ignored him and went ahead and did it anyway, and one through five, boom, 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 it all fell. Things like pornography, things like a greater than 50% divorce rate, things like a general lowering of the society's morality, these have all come to pass.
What's the divorce rate for NFP users?
Well, we'll get there.
Oh.
Okay. So, the point being that this book that you have in front of you, it's a fairly short read, but it's prophetic. And if you understand where the world was at that time, thinking, oh yeah, the church is just going to say whatever, and then you realize that he stood up and said, no, hold on, and that the Catholic Church has stuck with that teaching officially ever since then, that's because it's really important. And we need it in order to become Christ-like. Does this mean that you have to be pregnant as often as you possibly can? No. The Church teaches responsible parenthood, which means that you may have one child and discern that having another will be mentally too much to handle, or your body will destroy itself or be destroyed if you have another child. Or you may have 7 children and clearly have room for number 8 or 9 or 10. It becomes a discernment process between 2 adults, and we discern it between ourselves and God. The other part of that is that, you know, sometimes if you're not using an artificial means of birth control, you can change your mind at any time. We could be like, yeah, we're not going to have children for a little while, and then, you know, we have at least one child that we could name total lack of self-control. So the point is that instead of inserting something into yourself or implanting a device or taking a pill that causes cancer at the same rate as asbestos, instead there are other ways of making decisions as to whether or not you're going to have a baby or put off having a baby, and this is called natural family planning. I want to digress just a little bit because I'm
actually can I digress before you digress?
Yes, before you digress.
Just a quick comment on the humanity thing. If you've never read it, again, just to echo what Sylvia said, please, regardless of what you may think about this teaching, read the document and understand that what you're reading is the constant witness of 2,000 years of Christian tradition.
Unchanged.
Period. Yeah. Yeah. Right? It's something that we can trace back to the apostles themselves. So it's a consistent, unchanging teaching over 2,000 years. So I think it's important to take note, because when you distort how we understand human sexuality, everything else falls apart. Because it's through the marital act that the husband and wife become an icon of the Trinity in a very real sense by giving birth, or by the possibility of life being brought into existence.
So, 2 become 3, just like in the Trinity.
Or actually 1 in the child, yeah?
That's true.
Yeah.
That is very true. And that then ties us back into the divorce issue. If you have a child, they're made up of equal pieces of DNA from each person, and you can no more separate the DNA separate the two parents' DNA from in the child as you can break apart a marriage. It's the same thing. You can't rip apart a child and say that one is my gene, that one is your gene, that one. They have become one. And it's the same when you have an authentic marriage. You two have become one and you can't be separated. And that's actually the language in the marriage ceremony. The two will become one flesh and they will be separated. I wanted to tell you how the contraceptive pill works, because that's kind of the standard go-to for contraception. And, you know, why does the Catholic Church always have to be about artificial birth control? Well, here's why. I've already told you that it causes cancer at the same rate as asbestos. So you're taking into your body a pill that's going to cause cancer in you. I work as an EMT on an ambulance. If we get a woman of childbearing age on there who's complaining of anything, one of the first questions I ask is, are you taking the oral contraceptive? Because it so negatively impacts your health that there are a whole slew of very serious things that could happen as a result. If you smoke in addition to taking a birth control pill, then your chances of heart attacks and blood clots and pulmonary embolisms and all the list goes on and on, they just skyrocket. The pill works in 4 ways. Number 1, thickens the mucus at the opening of the uterus so that the sperm can't get through as much. It stops 2/3 of the ovulations, does not stop all the ovulations. So there are babies that are conceived during pill taking. The third thing that it does is it stops the movement of the fallopian tubes. It's kind of like when you swallow, even if you're standing upside down, you'll still get the food down into your stomach. The fallopian tubes do the same thing. It's called peristaltic movement. It pushes the new baby along the fallopian tube and into the uterus where it will implant and grow. So the pill stops that motion. And then finally, and I think most diabolically, it thins the lining of the uterus. So the baby is trying to get down to the uterus, because in the uterus there's this nice thick lining, and the baby will nestle in there and eat the food that's inside and set up its own housekeeping systems and stay there for 40 weeks. But if you're taking a pill, that will thin the lining so that the baby comes into the uterus and there's nowhere to nestle in because the lining is now this thin and has no food in it. And what happens to the baby? The baby starves to death and dies. It doesn't prevent conception. It's an abortifacient. It aborts the babies. It's the same with things like the IUD. It does not prevent contraception. It does not prevent conception. It simply aborts the babies that are conceived. So the church being life-affirming, because we're about Christ, and Christ is life and gives us life and gives life to the church, and we give life to the world, doesn't do the death thing. So the church says no, because people are dying as a result of this. So here's the number of surgical abortions, and we all know that, you know, that's an inconvenient thing. Up there, like 3 miles up, is the number of chemical abortions that are happening every year. Do I think everybody's evil who uses contraception? No, because most of the time we just don't know. We have no idea. If you read the literature that comes with a pill, you'll see in very small letters it says prevents nidification. Nidification is the nestling in that the baby does. That's really your only indication of what's happening there. They're not going to tell you the other things that happen as well. Even people who have sterilization, there's this massive connection between personality disorders and men who have been sterilized. I mean, it's just, if you break your body, you change the way that God intended it to be, it's going to make it hard for you to function. So, instead, there is this other form of true family planning. And I say that because you have the means to make a decision about, yes, I'm going to have a baby, no, I'm going to have a baby. And you can make that on a daily basis. Natural family planning. I have 10 children. Does natural family planning really work?
Yes.
Yes! Yes, it does. But you'll find that as you use it, you begin to be more open. Yeah, we could probably have another baby. There is no greater gift you can give to your children than a sibling.
But I think what's important about using an FP as a couple is it forces certain conversations that aren't going to happen.
And they happen on a daily basis.
Right.
Here's the other part. That's the divorce rate of people who use a natural means of family planning, compared to the greater than 50% across the board in our society right now. So when the church is, you know, talking about no contraception, you know, you gotta have no sex before marriage, and blah, 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 and everyone's like, oh my gosh, these people are such crazy, backward people, it's because it's for our own health and well-being. It's so that we will live. It doesn't mean you have to have a gazillion babies. It just means be open to God saying, hey, could you take one more? If you can't take one more, it's okay. You're not going to go to hell over it. But, you know, if you can, try. And it will rub the edges off of you. The Bible says that women will be saved by childbearing. Holy cow. I was like, that is so rude. Like, how could you say that? Like, I'm going to get big and fat, and that means that I'm gonna be saved. No. It's the 2 o'clock in the morning, and the 2:30 in the morning, and then the 4 o'clock in the morning. And then you wake up to dirty dishes and screaming children and husbands. That's what gets you.
Screaming and dirty husbands.
I'm not changing your life. That's what sanctifies you. That's what makes you holy. It's that gift of self. So.
And just, I mean, NFP helps with that because husbands have to learn that their wives are not objects for their sexual gratification. Right? And men tend to be driven, I mean, in very different drives than women. And so NFP helps the husband to learn what John Paul II calls self-mastery, right, or self-restraint, right? So, hey, what do you think about another kid? Well, not really into it because you come home late most days, and the three we have, like, are driving me crazy. Oh, I didn't realize that. Is there more I can be doing to help? I thought you'd never ask. Whole other conversation just happened that would not happen if the marital act was something that you two scheduled on a monthly basis. Regardless. Oh, every Tuesday at, you know.
Well, so I actually had a client who, she came to my NFP practice and she said, of course, you know that I sell this stuff, right? I'm teasing. I could teach this. She came to my practice and she's like, whoa. She goes, Sylvia, like, our sex was a business transaction. It was Thursdays at 7 o'clock. Like, that was the day. And she said it was like we were virgins again, because suddenly it wasn't just, well, it's Thursday at 7 o'clock, we got to do this because that's what's on the schedule. It was like, it was new and exciting again. You've taken away the barriers. You've made it something new with possibility. And for women, on the pill, that means they're always available. But we have a cycle that goes like this, and we're not always wanting to be available or feeling like that's what we want to do. So if you don't have a pill, you're only available here. Here, not the whole time. So it takes away the objectification, which is what you said, but I really agree.
Thank you. Any more on this, or shall we move on?
No, listen, we've had enough. This horse is dead.
And then another volunteer, please. The gentleman in the back.
Ah, perfect.
And what's your name, sir?
Sean.
Sean. That's the end of the day. That's okay.
We can call you Shauna if you want.
No. If you wouldn't mind reading paragraph 1654, it would be grateful.
Spouses to whom God has not granted children can nevertheless have a conjugal life full of meaning in both human and Christian terms. Their marriage can radiate a fruitfulness of charity, of hospitality, and of sacrifice.
So I think it's important to end on this note, because we don't want you to walk away from the talk hearing, well, if you don't have kids, then your marriage isn't what it's supposed to be. If you don't have children, there are other ways to be fruitful. Right, so the whole idea is that marriage is meant to be fruitful. Here, even the example is fruitfulness of charity. So taking care of others, you know, maybe you're called to adoption, maybe you're called as a couple to be involved in community service, hospitality, and sacrifice. Or maybe God didn't bless you with children, but maybe you're supporting, as philanthropists, lots of good causes. So the idea, again, is looking outside yourself, seeking to give yourself in a meaningful way, as an act of Christian love and an act of advancing the kingdom of God. Our next topic is the domestic church.
I just want to point out that the Roman Empire, the indomitable Roman Empire, was converted by the Christian family, by the example of Christian families who didn't let the babies that were thrown out into the cold lay there, and they took care of the lepers and they fed the widows. And,
That's actually that's a really good point. So there are some statistics that say that by the time of Constantine, conservative estimates, maybe as much as 40% of the Roman Empire was already Christian. And the Christians did a couple of things, and we have written records of this from some of the early writers. Talked about how they shared their board, right, so their food, but not their marriage beds, right, because the pagans were sort of into that. As Sylvia mentioned, it was the custom in late Rome for the dad to decide if a newborn child would live. Do you wish this child to live, yay or nay? And if the dad said no, the child did not live. The child was put out and exposed. The Christians would take these children and raise them. When plagues broke out, the pagans ran for the hills. The Christians fled into the towns, often at the cost of their own lives, to care for those who were afflicted. So basically, the pagans were seeing the witness of a Christian family, and they were seeing something that the world had never seen before. Right, authentic, life-affirming, self-giving love. And in a very real way, one family at a time, this is what changed the Roman Empire. It eventually led to the Christianization, right, of Europe and most of the known world. So, that aside, if I could get another volunteer, thank you, Sean, for having me.
But maybe there's more.
Here, would you care to read? There's a catechism coming your way. It's the floating catechism. He got one. paragraph 1655. It's actually a little bit of a confusing book. This is one of my favorite sizes of the catechism, because you kind of put it in the side pocket like a holster.
So 1655. This one is here, and I appreciate your willingness to read. What's your name, sir?
Scott.
All right, Scott.
Oh, I see.
No A in it.
The big green Scott one has a better index in the back, though.
That is true. Well, he was talking about the index and the big green one.
Oh.
So this paragraph right there on the domestic church.
Oh,
that's
true.
Yep, 1655. Yes, sir. And thank you, Scott.
So about the domestic church.
Yes, sir.
Christ chose to be born and grow up in the bosom of the holy family of Joseph and Mary. The church is nothing other than the family of God. From the beginning, the core of the church was often constituted by those who had become believers, together with all their household. When they were converted, they desired that their whole household should also be saved. These families, who became believers, were islands of Christian life in an unbelieving world.
Thank you, sir. So, kind of related to the idea of Christian marriage and Christian families, the Christian household, and what we mean by that is trying to build a Christian culture within your home. If you have children, or even if you don't, like, the only place that you act like a Christian shouldn't be in church on Sundays. You know, we won't talk about the parking lot behavior because, you know, all bets are off. Parking lot, get in, get out, no one get in the way. But you have to be intentional about bringing your Christian faith into your home. It's not enough to send your kids to CCD, because the church teaches the primary educators of the child to the parents. So the parents are the first witnesses of the faith to the children. And your kids are going to look at you, right? They'll listen to Father's homily, maybe. They'll listen at CCD, maybe. They're going to look at mom and dad. And statistically, dad's influence is particularly important. Some stats have shown, I think I read this with Mary Eberstadt, that if you have a faithful household where, you know, only one parent is observant, if it's the dad, statistically the children are more likely to continue in the practice of the faith. All of that to say, when you think of a term for the Christian family, is the domestic church. So that the nuclear family and the extended family is a place where husbands and wives and their children learn to live the life of Christ, learn to live the virtues, learn to exercise forgiveness on a daily basis, asking one another for forgiveness, apologizing, going out of themselves, serving the others. So that behavior has to be modeled in the home and then taken out into the world.
So some practical ways of doing this with our kids. In addition to sending them to CCD, we also homeschooled a lot of them. And then we would go out of the house to do work both for ourselves and for other people. you must love your brother, really, you must. We would go also places like convents and like in Berryville, there's a whole monastery that's over there,
the campus
over there. Both for service projects and to go to learn and to... You used to take them to do really cool things like at 2 o'clock in the morning when they have their middle of the night prayer. He'd go there with a couple of our sons and they'd be there at 2 o'clock in the morning like, whoa. Watching these men who have given their lives to Christ. I mean, how cool is that? What are the other things? Like, we take field trips to the different convent areas. Yeah, on our way north, we would stop at different saint sites. So in upstate New York, there's a place where Hikari Takakuita was martyred and where the North American martyrs were killed as well. So just everywhere you go, you know, there's always like a cool Catholic place somewhere around. So we did our best to take the kids out and let them see not just Catholicism, but Catholicism and how it's lived in the world the right way. And give them a chance to build this structure in their own lives. So even if they were to turn away, they would still have within them this structure and framework, like all the scaffolding is there. Because the Bible talks about train the child up in the way they should go, and when they're old, they won't turn from it. I don't say so much about like the mid-20s, which really stink, just saying, especially the parents. But as they get older and they have their own children, it's amazing how they turn back and they say, oh, maybe the dinosaurs weren't so crazy as we thought they were when we lived with them, right?
So. Yes. Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, as we... And you showed me this first. You pointed it out to me. But with some of our older kids, some of the conversations are a little bit difficult sometimes when it comes to things of the faith. But what's really interesting is underneath the conversation are always Christian virtues. Justice. Goodness. What's right.
Kindness. Yeah, righteousness. Doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
So a lot of the people who would, you know, taunt us for being here in RCIA at a weeknight, you know, 8:30 at night, you know, a lot of the modern atheists, what they object to are caricatures or misunderstandings of Christianity. But they also don't realize they can't say things like, well, we should just be kind to each other. Because they're living at the end of 2,000 years of Christianity. Like, the idea of treating someone well just because, it didn't exist before Christianity. Right? It was a revolutionary concept because Christianity raised love of neighbor to a religious obligation. The pagans have nothing on that. So,
yeah. And the Christians also started hospitals, and they started universities, and the rule of law, and a few other little small things that our society is founded on, not to mention the Constitution of the Founding Fathers. Anyway, I digress. So, yes, we have the fruit and the foundation that have been laid by these people who have given their lives for Christ over the last...
Another part of our building a Christian Catholic culture within the home extends to media consumption. Like, we curate what the kids watch. We curate the books we read to them. Because we want to give them examples of the things that they're going to hear preached to them. And the things we're going to say to them, hopefully, and try to model for them. We want all of those things to line up consistently.
The true, the good, and the beautiful.
Yes.
And it's awesome.
Okay. Another volunteer, please. Alexa looks away quickly. Actually, you've read already, right? Okay. Alexa, if we can bring the packages to us. Isabel has it right behind you. And this time it'll be paragraph 1657, and we are winding down. 1657, yes, ma'am.
It is here that the father of the family, the mother, children, and all members of the family exercise the priesthood of the baptized in a privileged way. By the reception of the sacraments, prayer, and thanksgiving, that witness of holy life and self-denial and active charity. Thus the home is the first school of Christian life. Thus the home is the first school of Christian life and a school for human enrichment. Here one learns endurance and the joy of work, fraternal love, generous, even repeated forgiveness, and above all, divine worship and prayer in the offering of one's life.
So I just want to sort of tie this part of our discussion off and show the connection between going to the liturgy together as a family, going to Mass, and how you live and behave at home, and also how you live and behave out in the culture. A lot of times we think about going to Mass sort of in terms of, I'm going to get something out of it. But as baptized Christians, you're going there because it's your privilege. Right? When you're baptized as priests, prophets, and kings, and you share the ministry of Christ. And part of how the faithful all share in the priesthood of Christ is by receiving the world and offering it back to God, transforming it more and more into the likeness of the kingdom. Else.
Marriage is hard.
Very hard.
If you...
But hard doesn't mean bad.
No.
Yeah, that was hard. That was very hard.
That was hard too.
Right? Reality of the cross, like, human values are flipped on their head. So, strength, right? That looks like weakness, but that's like strength. Right? And in the way he chooses to die, Christ shows us what it means to be truly God and truly man. And he shows us what authentic love looks like. Sorry.
I want to ask a question. How many people come from an intact marriage? Like, both your parents are still together. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. All right. And everybody else, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We come out of a place where we haven't had a good example of how this works. We don't see couples that are married much. You guys are 17 years along now, right?
Yeah.
Right on. But it's really hard, especially for the young ones, because... how do they learn something that they don't see modeled? So what we've heard a lot of people in our situation, where both of us are from broken homes, neither of us know a lot about our birth dads, we find ourselves saying things like, we're not going to let this go any further. We're going to learn what we can. We're going to do the diggity darnest bestest that we can possibly do so that our children have an example of how to do it. And we have to do that, because our world has fallen apart and we have the responsibility to pick it up and do our very best with the help of God.
And the Christian family, Christian marriage is really at the heart of that. We're now open for questions, comments, concerns, complaints, clarifications.
I'll take those.
Complaints department.
Just for the benefit of the people who came in a couple minutes late, could you explain once again how you are a priest who is married?
And
carefully?
Part of the Catholic communion?
Yes.
Yes. So the Latin Church, the Roman Church, is a communion of 24 self-governing churches. And I don't know if you guys have covered that or not yet.
So very briefly.
Okay. So these are churches that all maintain a relationship with each other through the Holy Father, the Roman Pontiff. One of those churches is in the West, the Latin Church. One of those churches is the biggest and most well-known, the Latin Church. All the other churches, the 23 others, are all in what was the Christian Eastern Empire. So lands that predominantly today are controlled either by the Ottoman Turks or the Slavic lands. So I'm a Melkite, Greek Catholic, not by birth, but by transfer of ascription some years ago. The Melkites are the Church of Antioch. So when you hear about Peter getting out of town quickly and going to Antioch and then on to Rome, or Paul going to Antioch where they were first called Christians. So think of the Arab Christians. Many people are surprised to hear that there are actually Christians in the Middle East. But remember that it was a Christian land long before it was a Muslim land. So that is why I'm dressed this way and why, yes, I am indeed a priest and I am married. You must be married, preferably for 5 years, before being ordained to the diaconate or the priesthood. And as for the Latin West, if your wife should predecease you, heaven forbid, you do not remarry if you wish to continue to practice the vocation to priest. How's that?
We do also have celibate priests as well.
Ah, thank you. That is really good. So yes, we just a slight history. When the Eastern Catholic priests started showing up in America in the late 1800s with the new migrations, the Latin bishops weren't quite sure what to make of them, because some of them were widowed, some of them had wives, and they were like, we don't think you're really Catholic. Go back to where you came from. Caused problems. So long story short, Rome requested that the Eastern churches not ordain married men. So sometimes said men would be sent to Canada or to the Middle East, ordained and brought back. My Bishop Nicholas Samra, who is the Bishop of the Melkites in the USA, brought the issue to the Holy Father in 2014, who rescinded the ban and once again allowed the Eastern churches in union with Rome to return to their ancient custom of ordaining suitably trained and qualified married men to the priesthood.
He must be suitable.
He vouched for me, so.
I think you're good.
And I do want to emphasize that you're as Catholic as Father Klein is. And a Latin Catholic can go to your
divine
liturgy, which is what you call the Mass. And somebody from your church can come to a Mass here, and it fulfills the obligation. It's a valid Catholic Mass all around.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. We tend to think in terms of unity and uniformity being the same thing. So sometimes people are kind of shocked when they visit our church because we don't, our church doesn't look maybe like St. Veronica's. It's a little bit different. And people are standing a lot and there's no musical instruments and everything is sung. And they're like, are you guys really Catholic? But I think it's important to remember in the ancient church, there was a wide amount of diversity. And uniformity didn't enter until relatively late, like the first Council of Nicaea. The 300s, you know, things started to kind of congeal.
Now, surely you must have some questions. Make one up if you don't.
Where's your, I guess, the parish you guys move to?
We're at Holy Transfiguration in...
In McLean. It's off of Route 7 on Lewinsville Road. Okay. Kind of before you get to the big mess that's Tyson's Corner.
Yeah.
a little bit to the north of that.
So. Okay. And it does fulfill your Sunday obligation.
Yeah.
Be forewarned that we use, we don't use hosts, we use bread.
It's similar to the
Byzantine Catholics is another name we're known by. The Melkites tend to use the term Melkite just because it refers to kind of a particular geographic region.
Okay.
And then the Slavic Eastern Christians tend to use the term Byzantine a little bit more. So, but yeah, we'd love to have you. Introduce yourself.
I'm prepared to stand up because we don't sit down. So it's like an hour and 20 minutes of just standing up. You can tell the newbies they're like.
Don't be shy about introducing yourself. You see a lot of faces and they're terrible with the ancient faces.
More.
Where do you go? Can that be the use of the contraception?
Well, so that's, you know, a lot of people say, well, you're manipulating time with NFP. So, yeah. And it could definitely be used in a way that would be harmful to a person. So this is not so much about being an accountant, like it has to be precisely like this and it's got a total upright. This is more about like, where's your heart? What's your intention? Are you open to life? Okay, then be open to life. If you can't, for a reason, be open to life, like how many moms that you know are like on kid four and the world is falling apart
in
for
five,
them?
In 5 years.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just mentally, it's too much to handle, or their body is giving out, or something has happened, where at least temporarily they need a break. God is not like, you better get pregnant. You're going to call yourself a Catholic? Well, by gum, you better have another baby. He's like, he loves you, you know, and he wants the good for you. And if you discern that you need a break, take a break. And this is a means to take a break without killing any babies and without doing the irreparable harm to your own body that comes from taking a chemical that destroys your immune system or injecting something in you that you can't get back out again, or, you know, the innumerable problems that come from that. So it's more about this than about the rule book.
Yeah, you can use an FP with a contraceptive mentality.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to be aware of. But the official teaching of the church, right, is that each and every marital act must be open to the possibility of it. And the FP allows for that. It's a good question.
All right, so he's two for zero. You guys have like zero.
So he doesn't even have an A in his name.
I know. What's he does? S E A.
I do.
S-E-A. There you go. There it is.
It's heavy in it.
See ya. Okay. Well, we were so good that we answered everybody's questions.
Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Yes.
And thank you for letting us ask you to be.
Tip your wages.
To the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us.
Amen.
Thank you very much. No class next week for President's Day, so I'll see you all in 2 weeks.